This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
Hey, good day, everybody. It's Dick Beyer here on the Lean Construction Blog podcast. And today we are joined by a really interesting fellow and a good friend who's, I think, going to add a lot of insight to the kinds of things that we talk about in the integrated project delivery world, Vince Chapman. Hi, Vince.
Hello, Dick.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
I think it's morning in Dallas, but...
It is a little bit. Yep.
That sounds like that just sounds like the title of a movie. Morning in Dallas, yeah. Starring Vince Chapman, yeah. And the Texas Rangers, who, you know, what happened?
Yeah, I think it'd be more correct to say a hot morning in Dallas.
Oh, there you go. Okay, yeah. Well, it's a beautiful fall day in Ottawa. Yeah. So let's jump into it. So your background is, I'm assuming that you started off life as an accountant, but tell us a little bit about your background, your education, where you grew up, all the things that kind of influenced your life going forward.
Well, sure. Thank you. Began in college at the University of Texas, and I, through kind of a trial and error, ended up in accounting. I was originally a philosophy major, and but switched over to accounting. My first accounting course, I failed. That solidified that I was going to be an accountant because I hadn't failed much in my life up to that point. And so I changed my major to accounting just to show them. And
I can completely empathize with that. My daughter flunked economics at the University of Colorado her first year. And I said to her, you know, there hasn't been a buyer in the history of the buyers that has finished in the bottom seven of 500 people. That's not going to happen again. So, and she's very successful now. So I'm very happy about that.
Well, you know, I learned a good life lesson is that you have to actually show up to class. So through that process, I started off in accounting, graduated in something that's unheard of now in 4 years. But I recognized kind of later in junior and senior year that I didn't really enjoy being accounting. And so I started taking a bunch of courses in real estate law, in various kinds of different law classes. And because I really intended to do something other than be a CPA. So I graduated, went to work for a bank, went through a couple of versions of that over a couple of years, and then was hired by a construction company, an electrical contractor, and became their only financial officer. And so did that for about 6 years. But in kind of interestingly, in that point in time in Dallas, that would have been early 80s, there were a lot of large developers like Lincoln Property, Trammell Crow, then also Gerald D. Hines down in Houston. And all those companies were doing work all over the country, and they were rather than design, bid, build, hard lump sum contracts, they were doing guaranteed maximum price contracts. So and our company I work for, the electrical contractor, was primary electrical vendor for Trammell Crow Company. And so we did a lot of guaranteed maximum price contracts, which kind of introduced me to one, obviously construction, but also the design build, design guaranteed maximum price contracts, which meant actual cost being charged and a fee, et cetera.
It's really interesting because at the same time in Denver in the early 80s, I was a lawyer for a big real estate firm, and one of our large clients was Trammell Crowe. And Trammell Crowe used to put together these partnerships where Trammell would come in and use his name and his influence and banking references and get hooked up with a local developer that was more or less successful. So there was always room for litigation, which I was doing at the time. But it's interesting because the things began to change then. And then we got into, of course, tax reform and the complete demise of the savings and loans, which most people who listen to this podcast will say, what are you talking about?
Yep. It was an interesting time. The savings loan industry in the late 70s, early 80s, especially given the, if you recall, the prime interest rate at that time being 20%. And how do you make a home loan if you're chartered to make home loans? How do you make home loans at 20%? It's hard.
It was crazy. It was funny. I showed up at the closing for a house I bought in Denver in 1982, and I brought out my MasterCard and said, I think it would be cheaper to put it on my MasterCard than close this loan.
Indeed.
Which was about right.
Yep.
Okay. So you moved from the electrical companies. The electrical company, one of the more famous and prominent ones in Dallas, is it still around?
Well, there's a version of it. The gentleman that began it is Jerry Mills. And so it was called Mills Electric. There's a company currently, I think that Jerry still has an interest in a company called JMEG, and it's Jerry Mills Electrical Group. But yes, it was one of the larger non-union contractors, electrical contractors in Dallas at that time.
Great. Okay. So you moved on to from Jerry's company. Where did you go next?
Well, had a year stint to work for a electrical distributor, so wholesale electrical distributor, and then a friend called me. Actually, a guy that worked at Austin Commercial in Dallas, and said, "Hey, I've got a guy at Trammell Crowe I'd like you to meet." And so I gave him a call, and so next thing I know, I was a part of a construction audit group that Trammell Crowe had just started like a year before. And our charter was to audit the guaranteed maximum price contracts that Crowe had across the country. I think we had 95 offices at that time.
Wow.
And so we were doing a lot of GMP projects. And so anyway, I was hired for that in that department. And a couple of months later, they made me the head of that department. So I stayed at Crowe through 91. And then there's obviously a real estate downturn for anybody that remembers those days. And the Crowe wasn't doing any more development. And it didn't make any sense that I was paying rent, effectively, my department's paying rent in Trammell Crowe Center, downtown Dallas, 33rd floor, rent. And so I left and went out on my own.
Interesting. Yeah. That's always a daunting challenge. In the early 90s, I went off on my own, and, I didn't actually ever have to work for anybody again until I went to Colliers a couple of years ago. A whole different story, but how did you find it out there in the world on your own?
You know, it was actually a pretty easy transition. Luckily, it's certainly not the same lesson anybody else would have, but I had a couple of clients that I had developed at Trammell Crowe, and including Trammell Crowe, because we still had quite a few projects that I was managing for them. Even though I was director of audit for the construction audit at Crowe, we did other things other than auditing, and some of which was kind of managing troubled projects from kind of a litigation support side. So kind of you appreciate this a little bit. you have to have someone within the actual company of the owner that is managing the lawyer teams, all the different teams, trying to get all the information together, being the person to answer questions. And so we had a couple of projects that were under litigation. One was in Milwaukee. And so I took those projects with me when I left Crowe. And then I had a couple of other clients, Hewlett Packard being one. And so I was just incredibly blessed to have folks that I took with me that other people had heard of. So it wasn't, some mom and pop organization that no one ever heard of. But so because of the, I think the ability to say, someone says, well, who do you work for? And you say, well, Hewlett Packard. At that time, also in the early 90s, Hewlett Packard was a brand that just everybody saw as number one in quality. So if you were associated with Hewlett Packard, you must be something.
Yeah, that's always good to take a passel of clients with you, which I did when I changed law firms. But when I went out on my own, it was like, just reinvent yourself, figure out what your next step is going to be. So you've been looking at construction companies and the way that they work and the way that they account, the way they spend money for more than 30 years, really.
Actually, yeah, 42 years.
Wow.
Because internal to that electrical contractor, but then auditing those contractors as well. So it's just, and the lens that I've had on it is, even though I reside in Dallas, because of that influence of Crowe across the country, literally we work on projects, and I have worked on thousands of projects across all of North America.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And then I gave you the opportunity to work in Europe if you hadn't done that before. So as you move through the process, because there were recessions, there were bangs, there were booms, there was the dot-com bubble and then the bust, and then there was the 2008 bank crisis, and there was, all of these different things. How does your approach to what you've been doing all these years, has it changed? Is it pretty much the same? What's happened as the market has either matured or dematured in some ways?
Occasionally I will get asked that question about what does a downturn in the economy do to our business, the construction audit business. So this is my opinion on it. It doesn't mean that it's the right opinion or that's correct, but it's certainly my opinion. And that is that what I've seen is that when the economy is going gangbusters, people don't want to pay attention to where the nickels and dimes are being spent.
It doesn't matter as much, right?
It doesn't matter to them. And so the percentage of projects that could be audited, should be audited, versus the ones that are audited is very low. And it's always been very low anyway. So I would say that my estimation is that the projects that get audited are certainly less than 10%, maybe more like 5% of all the projects that could be audited are. But in a in a growing economy, that number is low. In a downturn, developers, owners, whoever that's spending money on construction believe that what they're spending is the last dollar they'll ever have.
Right.
And so the percentage of projects that get audited goes up dramatically. Now, when I say dramatically, if 5% get audited now, then 10%, then it doubles, but it only becomes 10%.
Right.
But still, it doubles the amount of work. So our work is almost contracyclical to the obvious. When there's a downturn, more projects are audited and our business goes up.
So did you ever take your auditing expertise into for instance, bankruptcy court to support or audit companies that have gone into bankruptcy, or has it been straight market delivery, basically?
It's really just been, so I've never been, while there have been, maybe 10 times where I've been expert witness on projects, usually for owners, but not only for owners. Our work has all been just either helping an owner on the front end and developing a contract, or maybe even assisting, like we assisted the AIA in drafting contracts, and then through negotiating contracts, auditing contracts, but not really anything related to court appearances associated with contractors that have gone out of business or what should have happened.
Gotcha. Okay. So you've been more the active physician for the living patient rather than the coroner who comes in and declares the cause of death, right?
Well, that is true, except that I have had more than my fair share of contractors that tell me that my job is to bayonet the wounded. But that is not the intent of an audit, certainly.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting because in some senses, you're the big bad wolf, right? When somebody says, oh, we're sending Vince in and he's going to come audit your books. It's like, oh, my God, now I'm completely defenseless. How do you deal with them? I think you've dealt, at least in my experience, you've dealt really effectively with, calming people's nerves around what that is, that you're just looking for, a kind of truth that is defensible out there in the world, and that it's really just looking at the numbers and not at, personalities or blame or pats on the backs or attaboys or whatever that is.
So what we typically advise the owners that we represent is that the best bang for the buck is to make sure that we have a common understanding. I think you interviewed Will Lichtig, and one of his comments was, and I really took it to heart, is that just the lack of common understanding with contractors and owners as to what the deal really was from the beginning. And so one of the things that we try to do is to sit down, we call it a pre-audit, but we sit down with the owner and the contractor, and of course ourselves, and we go through the financial terms of the contract, but we explain to them our goal is to make sure that everybody understands what the contract says, what you can do, what you can't do, and from a financial point of view. And yes, we're going to do a final audit at the end, but we have succeeded if we don't have anything to report.
Right.
Our goal is to have nothing to report. And everybody has paid attention, done what they were supposed to do. And so we don't, and we never have gotten compensated based on finding anything. But nevertheless, the goal is to say, great, we succeeded. And so we just preach that constantly throughout the entire process. But occasionally, and I guess more than occasionally, contractors don't always pay heed.
Yeah, so I think that's our ultimate goal in especially bringing you in and your team in the integrated project delivery realm, is to start the project with a common understanding, to start the project with everybody understands what's in and what's out. So let's start with your first entry into the integrated project delivery world, as those contracts are meant to be different than the original contracts, but they do stem off of an idea around that's familiar to guaranteed maximum price contracts, in that it is time and materials defensibly, time and materials and as a component to that contract. So how did you get involved with IPD?
Well, actually, I had largely never heard of IPD other than maybe reading an ENR article from time to time. But a mutual friend of ours, Rex Miller, gave me a call. He was researching topics or researching information for a book he was going to write in the early 2000s, I think. And so he called me up and asked me if I would talk with him. And I think mainly the reason he wanted to talk to me is, I think, to point out how not to do things or why IPD is better, because look at all the controversy that happens with, you know, auditing and how the system is broken currently under the guaranteed maximum price arrangement. But anyway, so through that process, I first met Rex, and then I met you, and so rapidly we also started working on a project for Google that had intended to be IPD. So all of those kind of happened, one after the other. I think we also had represented American Airlines, and they were thinking about doing an IPD project. So it was just kind of a natural result from many of the institutional owners that we had worked for, that they were thinking about IPD. Rex kind of introduced me to the subject, started researching it more, and I just kind of fell into it, kind of a random walk.
Yeah, nice shout out to Rex for the commercial real estate revolution, which was his spin on why are projects failing and why can't we do better? And it's funny that many in the kind of lean IPD world said, well, you can't usurp what we're doing here. You've got to you have to take a more orthodox take on IPD rather than all these other contracts. And I'm proud to say that I was able to kind of bring Rex into that LCI community and establish him as really a thought leader in not only doing better, but also all of the work that he's done in emotional intelligence and relatedness and the important soft skills that people need. He's done a great job out there, and they wouldn't necessarily, people in the world wouldn't necessarily think that a former litigator or an auditor ever thought about having soft skills. And yet I think we can relate to, we can thank Rex for helping us understand that really, that other side of the picture, which is really what I was getting to. And I said, when you prepare these people who are going to be audited, it's not with a blindfold and the last cigarette. It's, let's think about how the project is going to be delivered. So, what was your first IPD audit assignment, if you can remember?
I believe the first one we worked on was a project for Google. Ultimately, the project got put on hold, and when it came back, it was not IPD. It's just now completed. So it went over a journey of about 15 years, or maybe not quite 15. Maybe it's more like 12 years. But nevertheless, that was the first, I believe, the first assignment I had. But then rapidly, we had assignments for Sutter Health. And so the kind of got immersed into the that same world of and in the same general vicinity, Northern California.
Right.
And it probably wasn't a coincidence that working for both Google and for Sutter, given that they, a lot of the people that are working on those projects kind of overlapped, as you know. So we run into the same folks, consultants and attorneys and the like in many of these IPD projects.
Yeah, there's a small list of usual suspects that's posted on most post offices in the vicinity of an IPD project. And it's, you have a lot of the same friends who show up and try to do better.
Yep.
But it's, so as you came into the IPD space, now you're you're dealing not only with contractors, but you're dealing with trades, you're dealing with designers, especially. And the thing that I've always said, that the issue that I've had, or the challenge that I'm looking into, I guess, and I'm doing a presentation at LCI next week, which will have been done by the time this airs, on generation owner, that it's time for the owners to actually demand more from the supply chain. Because the current offering of the contractors is more of a campaign, you know, a four-year campaign where you assign your army to it and they all show up, as opposed to a service industry where they put the people on the project that are necessary at the time. And the designers, I've always thought, had a really hard time kind of understanding their own business model, because they do a lot of different things. They design, they produce drawings, they supervise construction, they try to, you know, build their business. And they're all very different things that they try to do within that. And so I'm really interested from your side, because you get into the treasure chest and look at how they posit themselves for their business and for their model. And so what did that exposure to all those different kinds of participants in the built environment, what was notable about that?
You know, very interesting. You mentioned that about the architects or designers and how they really have different things they're providing to the owner under one contract, but it's the disciplines are entirely different. One of my very earliest clients when I started my own business in probably 93, I guess, was FedEx. And one of the things that FedEx was doing is they're building sort systems. Well, they were hiring a company to engineer the system, manufacture the system, and then install the system. And so you had engineering, you had manufacturing, and you had construction all in one contract, and yet trying to come up with a cost plus arrangement or a guaranteed maximum price arrangement for an engineering company versus a manufacturing company versus a construction company are entirely different.
Right.
And so not to dwell on that aspect, but just bring it back home to what you had specifically asked about, is that one of my early owners was American Airlines. And so we audited the designers for them, and specifically architects, but sometimes other designers as well. And what we noticed immediately, because I'd never audited an architect before, is, you know, the way they keep their books, way they keep their, you know, their segregation of design cost or direct cost versus indirect cost and overhead costs. And having audited then multiple architectural firms for a lot of different companies, many of them in the airline industry, realized that, wait a minute, it's not very, these companies are not, one, they're architects. And so therefore, accounting is not exactly their forte.
Yeah, this is like Star Trek. You know, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not an accountant.
Exactly. Exactly right. And so you found that they just, it was, I don't know, it's almost like a dice roll that they, you showed up and you weren't sure what you're going to get as far as their books and records were. And many times you had to kind of put them together for them. But you had to make them make sense, because here you have a contract. You have a contract that you're auditing for a particular owner. It has some basic tenets. We're trying to be fair. We're trying to interpret it the way theoretically the parties intended, and we weren't a party to the contract. And yet the records are not being kept in that way. And so we're, you know, our job is to try to sort it out and figure out what the costs really were, what should be direct costs, what should not be direct costs. But it is a difficult system, especially when the contractor or the architect in this case don't set up their system initially to track costs the way they have agreed to charge costs. And right. So we certainly find that when we're in the IPD realm, because in the IPD realm, the first instance, the first touch that we have to projects is to try to set an overhead rate. And so with architects, sometimes that is incredibly easy to do, but many, many times it is very, very complex only because their normal way of keeping their records are not consistent with the terms of that IPD agreement.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the struggles that we've had is that as we go through these iterations of contracts and the negotiation of contracts in the IPD space, we tend to want to kind of fine tune systems in the contract, which I've always kind of rebelled against because, you know, having been a commercial litigator with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars at stake in cases and several hundred thousand documents, everything you put into a contract becomes enforceable someplace. And if you put in there an aspiration, like Ian McNeil thought in the relational contracting, like let's put together a group of people that can kind of run this project and see how well they do without defining what they do, you're almost much better off than trying to define what they do. Because as we were discussing earlier, there's an expression in the law, expressio unus, expressio altus, which means if you say something, then you're presumed to have meant to say just that and nothing else. And that's really not true in the contracts, especially the way that we have stumbled through IPD contracts where we've tried to define overhead for some reason. We ran into this on the last assignment I had with you, where the contract had bounced back and forth in defining overhead, like it was a committee of people who got together in the marketplace that sold sheep and cheese and real estate and small cars, and they all decided, well, here's the pieces and parts of overhead. And we had to jettison that and just say, Vince, just go find out what their overhead is. And be more simple about it. So that's really the thing I wanted to discuss today, because this is a huge issue in the industry in IPD, because we try to define it in contracts and you're not there to define it up front. So, you know, at the end of this session, I want to see your recommendations on, you know, what should be put into the contract so we can do it. But we have so many different iterations and so many different models, and they tweak, you know, how profit is awarded and how things are paid. So I'm really interested in that, in your understanding of what overhead should be and what you found out. And is it different in design than it is in construction? And is it different in the trades than it is in the contractor? And does the owner system have to change to be adaptable to all of those things? So if Howard was here, he would object that that's a compound question, but he's not here. He's coming on later today. So
well, say
I'm going to ask a compound question.
Yeah. So let me try to answer the question, the part of the question I remember.
Okay.
Now that I'm older and had had COVID, that's my excuse for everything is that, I've had COVID. And it seems to work in the contracting community as well, is that we didn't complete on time because of COVID. So overhead is a very hard concept to define. I think that my preferred method, and it's always been my preferred method, and kind of shocked that it hadn't become universally accepted, just because I'm one that am the largest proponent of it, is that we should define what is a reimbursable cost, and then define overhead as everything that's not that, rather than put a name to the things that are in overhead, put a name to the things that are going to be in a reimbursable cost, which, by the way, we do, and then define everything else as not that, and therefore reimbursed as the part of that percentage, that overhead percentage that we are agreeing to. Now, I will say that there are certain types of other costs, non-reimbursable costs, that owners and contractors and designers might want to discuss as to whether those type of costs are good, would be not just non-reimbursable, direct reimbursable, but also not included in the overhead at all, and therefore only paid out of the profit. Right. So bonuses of some type are often discussed in that realm. Certain types of maybe marketing or lobbying expenses, because they're, you know, occasionally we have both designers and contractors that employ lobbyists affect changes in regulations and the like. There could be charitable contributions and some things of that nature, but it's a small list. I would say that it should be a short list of those things that we wouldn't include in our calculation of the overhead. It must be paid for out of profits.
Two of the things that have come up lately, not to cut you off, and then we'll both forget the question, the compound question that I asked, but two of the things that have come up lately that have sparked debate inside our consultancies have been bad debt write-offs and income tax. That all of the entities that we've been talking to lately say, well, yeah, so if it's a bad debt, I'm not getting that money. And so if it's, I still have to pay my people and then I have to pay income tax on top of that. How could that not be overhead? How could that not? That's what's keeping my doors open. And so how could that not be, be overhead?
Well, yeah, I think that the, shame on me for not bringing up those two examples, but partly because I just reject out of hand the notion that those two types of expenses are expenses at all. The whether you pay income tax or you don't, or you have an obligation to pay income tax or you don't, should not be a line item that we're calling overhead expenses. And so I think that just naturally we should be rejecting those and say those need to be paid out of profits as well.
I think fundamentally you're not paying income tax unless you made money.
Exactly. And so are you therefore by including income tax in your overhead calculation, you're basically assuming that this entity is always going to make money, and therefore I'm reimbursing them for something they're always going to do. But that's certainly not always the case, as we know. And I would say that the whether income tax percentages go up or down or sideways, again, should not be an overhead expense. And most financial statements separate those two types of expenses from each other. Now, the first one that you mentioned, bad debts, is a slightly more interesting one. But I think that my take on it, and this is, so I'm not going to call myself an accountant, what I believe I know from accounting is the reason that we're calling bad debt expense an expense at all is that we don't have another way of redefining income that we assumed from a prior period. So what bad debt is actually just reclassifying revenues from a prior period because we overstated revenues last year. Now we have to show the offset, the expense this year. Whether you made revenue last year or you didn't doesn't mean that the work that you performed that you didn't get paid for is somehow an overhead expense.
So if I think of it very simplistically, there are two things that you look at generally. You look at revenue and you look at expense. So you have money coming in or you don't, or you have money going out or you don't. So bad debt is just revenue that never showed up. It's still on the revenue side of the river. It doesn't suddenly cross the bridge to the expense side because it didn't show up. Is that close to what you're saying?
I believe so. Whether you intended to get paid for this or you didn't, it was a direct expense for a effort. The mere fact that you didn't make as much money as you wanted to, and not ever all bad debt means that you don't collect anything. Many times, of course, as you know, you collect a lot, but you didn't get paid that last bill.
If you're chasing bad debt, I mean, that's an expense, right? To go hire somebody to go get it. but the bad is now is this, these are just all, you know, questions I wake up in the middle of the night and think about, which is weird. But most people who listen to the podcast know that I'm just a bit odd around that. But is this an issue with accrual accounting more than it is with just checkbook accounting, that you've, as soon as you sign the contract, you accrue that income as if it was on your books, and now you have to back it out somehow? Is it more of a problem in that area?
I believe so. Yes, that you're recognizing revenue when you've incurred the expense and or sent the invoice to the client. Usually when you've incurred the expense. And so you're recognizing revenue, you're recognizing expense. Later, you didn't get paid everything you thought you were going to get paid. And if it happens within the same year, typically, you just write down revenue. Right. But if it happens in a prior year, you don't have a way of writing down, or it's not generally accepted to just reduce revenue in the next year. What you do is create an expense.
Okay.
And again, so it's not a, to me, it is not a general and administrative expense is what we typically define overhead as. And so I think for that reason, just like the other examples that I gave, I think that you, are probably best, an owner is a contractor, people that are entering into the IBD agreement to identify that overhead cannot include bad debt, taxes on income, maybe some type of bonuses or maybe all bonuses, charitable contributions potentially, and lobbying costs.
So the last one, that I have heard, and this is this really goes to the bonus comment, that during COVID and during the you know, incredible black swan upheaval that caused, not only to our cognitive abilities but our social skills, our, you know, that I'm sure bills with depressive treatment went way up during that period of time. But one of the things that people were saying is that the market became very fluid after that. And in order to keep people, or is that something that they should be managing directly?
Dick, unfortunately, the audio froze on me, and so I didn't hear I heard the lead up to the question and the very end. I have so apologized.
Hey, no problem. Okay, so the question was, as the market became very volatile for employees and staff during COVID, because people were, you know, there was the great mass exodus where people said, well, I can just work at home. I don't have to be I don't necessarily have to be at work. And people said, well, I need to pay Vince a big bonus to snatch him away from his competitor. So Are those bonuses? Are those like retention bonuses? Is that more categorized as salary, or is that still one of those things that you would categorize as paid out of profit?
Yeah. So the reason that that I say maybe bonuses when I was say explaining what should be paid out of profits is that I don't believe, just like your actual question about the specific kind of bonus, I don't believe that all bonuses should be excluded. There are companies that we work for that do just categorically say all bonuses should be part of profits. But I actually believe, and it's a lot easier to not think in that regard and just say, well, that's the answer. But to me, it's a lot more nuanced. And so I think that there are certainly, absolutely, some type of bonuses that are typical and normal employee compensation, and therefore either should reside in partially in direct expenses or at least in the G&A expenses, in the overhead expenses. There are other type of bonuses, and I think, and I would say that some owners, some people even might think of overhead as being kind of this fixed expense. But the reality is that from year to year, there are certain types of expenses that are non-reimbursable to a specific project that come and go, that can only be averaged or look at over many years in experience, not just 1 year. And so that's partly why we try to average the overhead calculations over many years, at least 2 and maybe 3 years worth of averaging, rather than just take the most recent year or some other year, because 1 year certainly can be an anomaly. I think that over 2 or 3 or 4, it certainly isn't, or it's going to be smooth a lot. So your example, your specific example or question related to something that might have happened during COVID, I think would fall into my definition of what normally would be considered to be an overhead expense. Okay. What I would not want to be an overhead expense that would also give a name like bonus is certain types of ownership structures mean that an owner of the company collects as bonus profits from that business. And so there are owner's bonuses that are paid. And so for designers, it's very often the case that you have a group of people, between 1 and 10 that are effectively owners, partners in the firm. But they collect not as dividends, but as bonuses, their chunk of what the profits were of the company. Calling those bonuses are not the same as the normal bonus given to the people that are non-owners.
Right. But so that would fall into the category of that keeps the door alive, and it should be some kind of, we should be trying to figure out how to make that a reimbursable expense to your categorization.
Well, actually, to the profit distribution, I would say that part of profits. So it's not reimbursed as a direct expense, and it's certainly not reimbursed as a part of overhead. It is why we're agreeing to that profit percentage of 5%, 10%, 15%, whatever it is.
So if you're going to play in the we've lost your video here. I don't know if you turned it off because you thought it would be better.
I turned it off because I thought it was impeding the audio.
I think it's my bad internet, because every once in a while something shows up on my screen that says I'm unstable, and I agree 100%.
So how did it take you that long?
if you're going to play in the IPD world, I guess it would be better if you're a designer. And we have an example of that that you and I know, where you're not just taking money out of profits, but in fact, you have a salary that's reimbursable. So you can charge by the hour as a direct expense. And then you just lower your profit. And sometimes people take that as there are some tax advantages. I know when I sold my business, I took a small salary and tried to capture everything else as a capital gain. So there are some things that you do to try to, you know, move money around from a tax standpoint, but that doesn't really affect the way that we approach the IPD world. So I appreciate that. Okay, so that's overhead. And it is something that I really like your definition. I'm going to buy into that. That overhead is everything that's not a reimbursable expense. It's not directly attributable to this project. And then there are some categories of things that are not going to fit through the filter. And so we're going to have to put them to the side and look at them individually on most projects, whether it's retention bonus or it's some other kind of thing that we should give special treatment to. But in general, overhead is just what's not reimbursed expenses.
Yes, sir.
Now, we did get into a long struggle and we spent a bunch of money looking into one of the hallmarks of the IPD contract has been this idea that you pay somebody's contract salary and then you add to it the labor burden and then you do overhead. And then I think certainly with consultants, we found that they rarely separate those things out, that the labor burden, whatever it is, whether it is vacations or it's taxes that you pay, you know, employment taxes or contributions to pension or whatever, that just falls into that overhead category. And so as a consequence, it's easier for us to take contract salary of an individual divided by the number of hours that they work over whatever the entity demands of them, whether it's 20, 80 or 17, 35 or 6. And we create an hourly rate from that. And then the labor burden is part of that overhead that's not directly attributable to this contract. It's the stuff that's not a reimbursable expense. Those labor things fall into overhead. And so your overhead increases by whatever that happens to be.
Yeah. Yes. So it's a holdover from kind of a situation under a guaranteed maximum price contract with a contractor where you're reimbursing the contracting a company for the personnel that is on the project, and you reimburse them for their cost of labor burden, the direct cost of labor and labor burden, meaning taxes, insurance, benefits, the like. So that concept was something that people understood in the contracting community and say, well, why wouldn't that apply to the designers? But you're absolutely correct. The most common way for the architects and designers to keep their books is to charge direct labor to a project number, but everything else, taxes, insurance, all benefits, just get commingled into an overhead account. And so therefore trying to, when you ask the designer to give you a labor burden percentage on that direct labor, and then ask them, oh, by the way, also give me an overhead percentage, invariably what they don't do is back out the labor burden that they applied to the direct labor. Right. And now they've given you the overhead as it currently is accounted for, which also includes the same stuff that they're putting into the direct. So it becomes a duplication. And we have seen that many, many times, the same exact error being made. And so either it's partly because they don't understand it, they're architects after all, and they're not accountants, or they, and I think this is kind of, it's debatable, they didn't assume anyone was going to audit it.
Right. and that's, so one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to get through people's assumptions. And so we don't want them to necessarily make, you know, a wrong assumption, and we don't want them to be able to double stuff up, because it's an uncomfortable conversation when you have with somebody that maybe this is the way you've treated this all this time, but you know, you need to open your eyes to the fact that this is really double counting. That gets us to the contractor profit. So, I mean, one of the things we're trying to do in the IPD world is we are trying to make a really opaque process more transparent. We're trying to open it up so that we can kind of see behind the curtain, and it gives owners confidence that this is the cost of a project. And I think that's the fundamental thing about owners, is that most of them, and you know, every system has a 10% anomaly, so most of them don't want to get something for nothing. They're happy to pay for the cost of it if they know what the cost is. But for so many of them, they don't see the cost because they just get an invoice for this, you know, payment number 13 in a contract of 26 payments. And it's not transparent to them. So transparency is really important from my perspective, both to increase the confidence that the owners have that they're paying fairly for what they're getting, but also it allows the owners to create their own benchmarking process, their own costing, which is something I'm really advocating these days, because our costing has been so bad. Our predictions and our estimates have been so bad that even, you know, even my friends, HKS and HDR and some of these really big, very, very professional design companies have been on projects with enormous budget overruns. Some of my, you know, closest lean friends, Turner and Clark McCarthy and people that were at the original California Prison Healthcare receivership benchmark project, they've got these enormously over budget projects, which tells me not that these guys are hiding the ball and trying to take unfair advantage. It just tells me that our way of estimating what these things cost is really broken. And so what I wanted to, so that gets me back to kind of profit for contractors and IPD. And the model that contractors have had for since time immemorial, maybe not time immemorial, I'm a member of the Construction Historical Society. And there's a great article by David Yeomans about rebuilding the churches in London after the Great Fire of London in the 1600s. So there was a commission that was going to build these things, and they ran into exactly the same problems that we run into. They were value engineering. They were trying to get pine from Norway for these churches instead of oak from the forests of England. The masons, the stone guys that are building these churches were making the mortar too weak. I mean, it's all the same kind of stuff that we run into. Essentially, contractors have taken a fee on top of all of the construction costs, right? So whatever construction costs, they've taken a fee on that. And in the IPD, they say, I want 2% of the construction costs. And it seems like a low fee, but it's actually pretty pretty substantial. So what we have done in the IPD world is say, no, you can't have a fee at all construction, because then you're doubling profit in the sense that you're getting a fee on not only the work of the other IPD partners, but we're paying them profit on top of that. And then you want us to pay you profit on top of that. And that's paid more profit than the owner wants to pay. But that 2% fee probably isn't realistic. So why don't you give us a realistic fee, like an 8% or 10% or something like that? And they have resisted that mightily. And I think it's because they have a different kind of business than the business that would be really good for IPD. Their business was set up for a different kind of delivery system. But why don't you opine on that kind of long exegesis that I just laid out in front of you?
Well, you know, so for a long one, most owners that are in the IPD space, my opinion, have graduated to IPD from previous design build and or guaranteed maximum price contracts. And in those guaranteed maximum price scenarios and in the design build scenarios, you have a fee that is supposed to represent both overhead and profit by part of the contract. Now, what's happened is that owners have started to pit one contractor against another in the marketplace, saying, "What is your? We're going to select you based on the subjective criteria of who we think is most qualified, but we're also going to ask you in advance, what is your fee? Meaning, what is your overhead and profit?" Well, contractors, after getting beat up enough, recognize that the owner couldn't tell the difference subjectively between one team and the next because it all sounded good. So even though this fee calculation was only supposed to be 10%, 15% of the criteria of deciding who's going to be awarded the project, it became the only thing that the owner could measure. And so therefore, it became 100% on the fee. And so time after time, the contractors have gotten smarter and smarter. And they originally started off with a 4% fee, then went to 3%, and now 2%, and 1.75, and the like. Unfortunately, all you have to do is open up their financial statements and look at their what they call overhead as a function of direct cost and realize they need 3% to stay in business. So how [S2] Right. [S1] In the world can they do it for 2? So, but an owner still had this idea in their mind that fee that contains both overhead and profit is 2% or 2.5% or something less than what overhead alone is.
Right.
So there's a misunderstanding from the owner's point of view, partially created by the system they set up, but not intentionally set up in that way, but also because the contractors, again, are not audited very often. And so therefore they understated what their fee is and overstate what the estimate of cost is. So we've reached a system where owners come to a project thinking profit, the thing that we're going to call profit, but also thinking the thing we're calling overhead, and then the thing we're calling profit should only be a certain percentage, when the reality is that they've been misinformed of what those percentages are all along.
Well, and the reality is also that what I like to call little acorns on the lawn have supplemented these things, because as you say, nobody can survive on a 2% margin. So one of the acorns is rental tools, and one of the acorns is the cranes we own, and one of the acorns is the insurance that we supply. And this is not, you know, it sounds pejorative, but it's not meant to be either immoral or pejorative. It is just how you have to survive. And when you're in an opaque system, that's what you're encouraged to do. And then you're also encouraged to just be incredibly focused on scope. So if a bolt changes, you get a change order in there, because in your change order, you get 15 or 25% actual recognized additional overhead. So how is it that an owner comes to a project and they look at 2% for the overall project and every change order is 15 or 20%? You know, that's, how does that system work? So one of the things I'm trying to do is in my generation owner talk, I'm really going to talk about, we need to have some major construction companies out there that are service organizations see themselves as providing a service and not building stuff, because they don't do the building, right? The trades do the building, and we pay the trades separately, and we make them part of the team, and they get to participate fully in the agora, put their hand up and vote. So how do we move contractors to say, yeah, you know what? I want a 10% profit here. And I want you to pay me time and materials on all my GCs and the time that I spend supervising the non-IPD partner construction trades.
You know, it, really interesting. So, you know, we use contracts that call a contractor a construction manager, but then we don't treat them like construction managers. We pay them a fee on everything they spend, no different than if they were a general contractor and actually performing all this work or heavily involved in the work. And not to say that construction managers aren't heavily involved, because clearly they need, you know, we need supervision, we need scheduling, we need all of the procurement, we need all the things that a construction manager provides that we can't provide. But it would make more sense for the contractor to get a fee, overhead and profit, as a function of the thing that they're providing, which is management, and not the things that they aren't providing, which would be maybe subcontracting or the variety of the other things. So I would say that it would probably be more logical, especially in the IPD realm, that rather than getting overhead as a function of all costs and profit as a function of all costs, that it would be a function of only that which you are, that we're hiring you for, which is your management expertise. So it would create, it's not impossible, obviously, to calculate the numbers in exactly that way, which just take the direct labor costs from their accounting books and apply overhead against a much smaller number. And so now you're, rather than an overhead function of 3%, the overhead function is 100%.
Right. Yeah, so that makes ultimate sense to me. But the these are big battleships, you know, these construction companies, they're fleets, and it's hard to get them to understand that, you know, this in this day and age, you need some PT boats rather than you know, heavy battleships, or you need some light cruisers, or you need a catamaran, you know, to get around, so that you can come in and actually add the value that you need. That projects need. And it's even more of a servant leadership than it used to be in terms of command and control, because you can only yell at so many people for so long before they just stop listening, which is probably why I've been divorced twice. but that's a story for another day.
Yeah, that is.
All right. So one last question. One of the things that has come up in the IPD world, and this is just really looking for your personal opinion on it, is that people are now talking about something called value for money. And so they think that, to your point, that we compete even in the IPD world when we say we're only 15% looking at the fee and 85% based on the team. But it's very difficult to kind of figure out those differences between teams. That the only way to get value for money is actually to compete money for money. And I'm still of the view that it's only when the fungibility index is 100% that competing money for money actually makes sense. But how do we get owners to understand that the value for money proposition is not really whether you have competed to get the lowest hourly rate? It's really who is the person that is going to charge you. It's not going to charge you for the stuff you don't need. It's almost the value for money proposition is I'm hiring somebody who I'm confident will not charge me for stuff I don't need.
That is a in a way, it's a hope, I guess. It's so subjective that either you believe it or you don't believe it, because it is most difficult for an owner. There are certain types of services that an owner can discern whether somebody legitimately knows a lot more than another competing firm. Since I exist in a marketplace of construction auditing, where it is kind of a very small, little niche business, it's easy for us to kind of demonstrate that we're just not accountants and the like. But in a construction realm or in design realm, That is incredibly difficult to, because they all sound alike. And the people that you're, and many times the folks that are at the cream of the crop, the people that are in the room that we're interviewing, all are legitimately rock stars.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're going to have 50 people on our job, and the other 45 that are not in the room are the ones that are going to be actually making decisions and improving their worth. And it's not the five that are, you know, largely in the room. So I don't have a good way of trying to tell an owner how to predict what is, you know, what team we should elect versus the team that we shouldn't elect, other than just historical reference experience, either with that same team, obviously. And if we have the experience, then we don't need to go through the exercise again. But having sources that we rely on, that we find credible, to find out what they, what their experience is. But I, but just like one of the first things that I've learned in construction is that you're not hiring the company, you're hiring the person. And so that becomes a much more difficult when you are taking the same company that produced for you in Toronto and saying, oh, they must be good, and therefore in Vancouver they're going to be able to produce for me. Legitimately, you're not going to have the same team, and so it's really not the company anymore; it's the individuals, you know, specifically on that team.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because you know, even with my friends, the Turners of the world and the Ellis Dons of the world and the Clark McCarthy's of the world, you go to their offices, the Turner office in Chicago is substantially different than the Turner office in Buffalo. And they have different mentalities, and they have different things that they need to achieve or things that they believe they can achieve. And they're very, you know, in Dallas has one of the most homogeneous construction markets that I've ever seen, at least when I was down there on Parkland Hospital. That everybody knew each other. Everybody seemed to get along. The trades knew everybody. Everybody worked really well with each other. They would celebrate together. They would do all kinds of things together. And yet in other places, people are breaking windows out of other people's construction trucks and, you know, putting nails in their tires and stuff. So it's very different. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, there are places where the folks that work for those construction companies are very siloed, that they've been, you know, they were an intern at that company, and now they're near retirement at that same company. They never, you know, you never change brands. Right. But Dallas has always been where you, it's very common that you've worked for three or four of the larger construction companies in your tenure. So you have better appreciation of the people that you're working with, and recognize that you know, all of them are good organizations. There's no hatred associated with it, but it's easier to do when there's a lot of work. When you're fighting over the last meal, then the buzzards don't get along as well.
That's true. Yeah, and there's no place like Dallas for. Somebody having a cousin with a barbecue truck that shows up for topping out or whatever, that's, it's big on celebration. We should take that other places. So the last thing I think, one of the big things I've gotten from this discussion, Vince, I really appreciate you taking the time, is that maybe we should have you on the team up front in drafting the contract, so that we are actually the thing that we're asking for of designers and contractors. In that initial RFP and in that contract, are the things that they should be delivering and that they can deliver, and that make your job easier going in, rather than having, you know, a fight over the fence over, you know, a number of different items that are carried in people's books.
You know, Dick, one thing I do want to tell you is that I think that, yes, we probably could add some value on the front end. And depending on how complex the arrangement is, the more value or less value it is. But the what I think the counsel that I would give to the various participants, the risk reward members, is to explain to them that the way they keep their books and what they're calling overhead in their system, in their normal accounting system, is not necessarily what is overhead as defined in this contract. And so for them to take heed to that, because someone like myself, and I think it's best practice, I know it sounds very self-serving, but I absolutely, my experience is that that the typical way, the typical risk-reward member keeps their books on what they call overhead is not indicative of what is overhead by this contract.
Right.
Many of these contractors will put certain kind of direct costs into overhead, and therefore their overhead appears to be higher. And many do just the opposite. And so what so on the front end, the counsel that I would give to the partners, and these are, you know, that's what everybody in this process is. The way you would treat your partner is to tell them, hey, watch out for that bend in the road over there, because otherwise you might go off that cliff. Well, that's what we would be doing, is to advise our partners that you can't rely on the way you're keeping your current records. You need to make sure that you recognize that only these type of thing costs are going to be reimbursed. But all of those kind of costs are going to be reimbursed. We had a large traditional subcontractor in California, where all of their project managers, all of their superintendents were charged overhead because they didn't normally work on larger projects and it was just easier for them. Of course, when they calculate their overhead calculation, it's 20% of direct costs. But when we show up and say, wait a minute, we're going to directly reimburse you for supervision, we're going to directly reimburse you for project management, the numbers, you know, come down significantly. But also, it happens in the reverse. And so it's really important that everybody is fully appraised of how they're going to get reimbursed, and there's clarity to the deal. So there's no surprises. Everybody is walks into it with a common understanding. And again, at the end of the day, there's nothing to report.
Well, and that's where we want to be. So it's the end of our day. We have lots to report. We'll get this up on the internet. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom, my friend. You're a gem out there. So I appreciate you.
Yep. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.